Greetings and welcome to What's About Florida, a monthly discussion program tackling the key topics of interest to our state. I'm Lynn Hatter. Today we're speaking with reporters Gray Rohr and Kathleen McGrory at week three of the 2015 lawmaking session. Gray Rohr is a reporter for the Orlando Sentinel's Tallahassee Bureau, and he has reported for other publications like the Florida Current, covering the legislature and state government for the last 4 years. Kathleen McGrory covers state government and politics for the Miami Herald. Her previous beats included Breaking News, the Miami-Dade School District, and Miami City Hall. Our conversation with reporters Gray Rohr and Kathleen McGrory coming up on It's About Florida. Well, greetings, guys. Welcome to It's About Florida. We're happy to have you today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me, yeah.
So we're at week three of the 2015 legislative session, and already we've seen a lot of issues that are quickly moving through. And I think one of the ones that's dominating a lot of the conversation right now is the issue of Medicaid and the low-income pool. So I want to start there. Because the Senate has unveiled a plan that would allow them to pull down about $50 billion in federal money to expand Medicaid in some form, and the House does not want that. So where are we, and who wants to try and tackle this one first?
I can try to take a stab at it.
Okay, Kathleen, go ahead. Where are we with this?
Well, Medicaid expansion is something that's been a possibility for the past 3 years, and we've seen the Senate have a willingness to try to go ahead and draw down those federal funds, but the House has been very, very resistant to it. They don't like it ideologically. They think that Medicaid is a broken system, that we shouldn't be expanding it, and they don't like its affiliation with Obamacare, frankly. So it's become a bit of a hot-button political issue, too. So we're seeing the Senate unveil a plan that would enable Florida to tap into those dollars by creating a private health care marketplace. It'd be run by the state, and folks who participated in it would have to pay small premiums, small monthly premiums. There would also be a work requirement. And they're saying, look, you know, this isn't Medicaid expansion as envisioned under the Affordable Care Act. This is an alternative. And they were really hopeful that the House would be on board. You know, they've got the support of the business community. They've got the support of a lot of consumer advocacy folks. But the House just does not want to play ball. And even yesterday afternoon, House Speaker Chris Foley said, look, you know, this is just not a plan that we're interested in.
How does the issue of the low income pool factor into this conversation? Now, that's about it's a billion dollars in federal funds matched by $1 billion that goes to hospitals that treat large numbers of low income patients. LIP as we know it is going away, but the House seems to think that it will be replaced. I think Matt Hudson, Representative Matt Hudson of the Appropriations Committee said yesterday it'll come back by some other name, but it seems they're pretty certain it will come back. So how is the LIP conversation factoring into this?
That's a good question. If you talk to Representative Hudson, like you just mentioned, and Governor Scott, they try to delineate, saying there are two different programs and two different issues. And they are, but the problem is that they cover if both were to go through, they would cover some of the same populations. LIP is federal money that sort of pays for health care on the back end of for people that are uninsured or low income, people that can't afford to pay. And so essentially one of the arguments for Medicaid expansion is that if these people were to have coverage on the front end and do preventative care, it would cut out some of the healthcare costs because those unpaid cost of care, uncompensated care, shows up in everybody else's premiums, and that's one of the big things that business groups like the Florida Chamber want to see in the Medicaid expansion plan is a guaranteed cost reductions for that purpose. So there's some suggestion that this could replace LIP and it would solve the budget problems, and that's another issue because that sort of at a standstill between the Senate and the House right now.
Well, speaking of the budget, we've started seeing House and Senate plans rolling out, and I want to start on the subject of differences in education
because that's been kind of highlighted this week, where we saw the governor wanted, you know, he promised record spending levels. He wanted more than $1 billion to go into it again this year. Obviously not quite at $1 billion. I think the Senate is pitching a plan that just goes a little bit over. The House puts more money into education, but less than what the governor wanted. Obviously, education is going to get more funding, but I'm just curious about what does this mean for Governor Rick Scott, where, you know, education seems to be one of those things everybody wants to say, hey, we did something, but it doesn't look as if he's going to get what he wants on this front.
And that's what Senate Budget Chairman Tom Lee has been saying all along, that look, because we do have this potential giant hole in the healthcare budget, we're going to have to build an austerity budget. And that's going to mean not a lot of member projects. That's going to mean, you know, not a lot of spending on new initiatives. And we're certainly seeing that attitude when we look at what they're proposing, what the Senate's proposing for the overall education budget. And you're seeing that in the House budget, too. You know, Governor Scott wanted to hit – he's had this number that he's been – he rolled out on the campaign trail. He wants to spend $7,176 per kid. You know, that number that the House came out with doesn't hit that. The number that the Senate came out with doesn't hit that. And I had a conversation with House Education Appropriations Subcommittee Chairman Eric Frezen, and he said, look, this isn't intended to be a slight at the governor, but this is the reality that we're facing. And it's that, you know, we'd love to spend more money on education. We'd like to try to spend more than 2007, 2008, which was the last high watermark. But unfortunately, you know, what Governor Scott wants to do just isn't in the cards this year.
And I think it probably should be noted. I mean, they will spend more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suspect they will end up spending more. I mean, both chambers are looking at spending not quite an extra $1 billion, but, you know, spending more than, I think, around $700 million more than last year, specifically in K-12.
You know, one area that lawmakers will be spending more, and it's not necessarily by choice, is in agriculture and the environments, courtesy of Amendment 1. Now, you know, our listeners may remember that was the constitutional referendum that basically told the state it would have to dedicate a portion of the revenue from home sales to go to conservation, land conservation projects, and water projects. And now we're seeing what that looks like, $772 million. But there are some differences in how both chambers are going about divvying up those funds. Now, I know, Gray, you've been kind of watching this for a while. What are you seeing?
Well, good question. It's already the environmentalists that environmental groups that push the amendment are not liking, especially what's in the House budget. The House just unveiled some of their projects have to do more with land management, and that's been a real key issue for especially on the House side, is and Speaker Chris Cifulli wanting to take care of the land that the state already owns rather than sort of buy up more land. And then there's other issues tied into this. The environmental groups want the state to act on its option to buy land south of Lake Okeechobee so that water can flow into the Everglades instead of sort of spewing out pollution to east and west of the river, which was a big issue leading up to this year. So it's the environmental groups are already, you know, a little irked. On the Senate side, there's the Springs, and they tend to like that a little bit more because the Senate wants to do more projects with Springs, preserve those areas. But the reason that they're irked, the environmental groups have already sort of compared this issue to the lottery, where several years ago the lottery money was supposed to go to education. Well, it did, but the other money that was going to education before was swept out, and sort of this three-card money trick that lawmakers can pull, because at the end of the day, they appropriate the money. So yes, there will be more money going to some of those projects, but are they the projects that the environmental groups intended, and is it in place of other money that's being spent elsewhere?
Something that died this week, it's only week three, it's still early in the legislative session, but pretty clear indication that it is dead is when the House Speaker, Steve Crisafulli, says, yeah, we're not going to move forward on state pensions. And that was that was something, you know, on the first day of session, he was like, we need to reform the Florida retirement system. 3 weeks later, a study comes out that says, yeah, if you want to close the pension plan, it's going to cost you a lot of money. And now that's a no-go. Kathleen, what happened?
That was something that was surprising to all of us. That was a priority for the former House Speaker, Will Weatherford. You know, he tried to get it done. He wasn't able to get it done. It was something that had met an awful lot of resistance in the Senate. But when we were kind of – when I was kind of looking at all the cards on the table thinking, how is the Senate going to get Medicaid expansion done? I was thinking that one of the things that they might be able to trade in some way, shape, or form would be, you know, pension reform, and maybe that would be on the table. But then the Speaker went and took it off the table really quickly. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting when you look at the chessboard to try to figure out what the moves might be. Mm-hmm. But that was it was unexpected, I think, at least.
Mm-hmm. What was the figure that they put on that? If you close the pension system, it would cost the state a couple $100 million. Like if you close down pensions, Florida would end up paying more because of that closure.
Right. I'm not familiar with the latest study, but there was the study that when former Speaker Weatherford was pushing it, that it was no. I mean, the study said it'll cost money in the short run, but mm-hmm. save money if you go out several decades. So the short run thing was not the surprising part. The surprising bit was that it'll still end up costing money in the long run if you do this. So.
And, you know, following up on pensions, while the state pension issue is dead, the local pension issue is very much alive and well. And that's really been kind of fueled by problems with local pensions that are really insolvent. I think Jacksonville, city of Jacksonville, has been held up as kind of the poster child for really bad pensions. You know, their pension is definitely in the red. And that seems to be something that a lot of groups have come together and said, okay, yeah, we've got to fix it. And lawmakers seem to be moving bills quickly on that front. Coming up and on the verge of passing is, or rather are, two bills that deal specifically with something Florida knows very well, education testing. Obviously, the rollout of our new Florida Standards Assessment did not exactly go to plan. There were a lot of there were some problems.
To
there
say
were a lot
the
of
least.
Mm-hmm, a lot of bugs and a lot of glitches. Kathleen, you've been following this issue for a while. What exactly do these bills do? And how are the parent groups who have been very vocal about them, how do they feel about them?
Well, these are specific bills that would scale back testing. Over the past couple months, we've really seen parents across the state really coming together and saying, look, our kids are under way too much stress. There's too much pressure. The stakes are too high, and there are just too many darn tests. And complaint came about at an interesting time. There was kind of a weird merging of folks, you know, some people who politically speaking are on the far left who just don't like the idea of high stakes testing and don't like how it's been carried out in Florida. And then folks who are on the far right who had problems with the Common Core state standards, very controversial, with Florida, you know, adopting new standards that were based on those Common Core standards and new exams. These two groups of parents kind of came together, met in the middle, and really started rallying for change. So the lawmakers almost had to act this year. So what the bills would do, and there's, you know, they're defining characteristics of the Senate bill and the House bill. But in broad picture, I mean, they would scale back testing. So they're both seeking to eliminate a new 11th grade English language arts exam. They would both eliminate a requirement that districts have to come up with tests for every subject that's not covered under the Florida Standards Assessments. Those are the state's new tests. The Senate version would actually cap the number of hours students could spend testing. The House version doesn't have similar language, but they're saying it would, you know, it would help. It would cap, you know, testing just without that hard number.
You're listening to It's About Florida. We've been speaking with the Orlando Sentinel's Gray Rohr and the Miami Herald's Kathleen McCrory about where lawmakers stand at week three of the 2015 session. Now back to our conversation.
You know, obviously, you know, everybody said that, oh, this new Florida Standards Assessment is supposed to be a big improvement. We want to go deeper into student learning. You know, we want to really focus on critical thinking. I mean, that was what this was sold as. Obviously, mm-hmm. we know this is Florida Standards. We're based off of Common Core. A lot of Tea Party groups, a lot of local groups really don't like that. You know, has this started the any kind of conversation of, you know, do we keep this system in place?
Yeah, I think we're almost at a point where we kind of have to keep the system at place. We've gone pretty far. The whole move towards the Common Core, we saw that start to happen here in Florida around 2010. Folks were saying that the standards that we had in place, they were called the Sunshine State Standards and the Next Generation Sunshine State Standards. Oh, that's a mouthful. but they were saying that they were, you know, a mile wide and an inch deep, and they didn't encourage critical thinking skills or analytical skills. So Florida was one of many states that were looking at kind of coming together, taking the standards that were the best, looking at what was being done in states like Massachusetts and New York, and then trying to adopt a common set of standards. And it was never something that the federal government was doing, but rather that the states had come together and said, let's do this. Became a total political hot potato, you know, to the point where it was just the effort was denounced by the far right as a federal takeover of education. The rhetoric was heavy. You know, in that kind of the politics really did take over the policy conversation. You know, Florida, we had the Common Core state standards. We tossed them. We made a couple tweaks. We now call them the Florida standards. You know, but they've been in schools now for a couple years. So I think it would be really challenging for us to totally roll back on that. And frankly, some of the opposition in Florida seems to have died down a bit as we've moved forward. But this year was the first year that we saw the new tests take place, and that's where all the controversy's been over the past couple weeks. They rolled out new online tests in 8th, 9th, and 10th grade for reading. And frankly, it was a mess. There were software programs. Districts across the state couldn't log in for the first 2 days of testing. There was a cyber attack on the fourth day of testing. So students were getting these white screens. It was really a mess. And folks are very nervous about what's going to happen when the second round of testing starts for two reasons. Because one, there are more tests coming. There are going to have to be more students logging on to the servers to take reading and math tests. And these are tests that are actually, like, physically, the tests themselves are a little bit more complicated. They mm-hmm. require dragging and dropping. And, you know, it just has the potential to be problematic.
Well, if the legislature passes these bills, will they kick in before students have to take phase two?
No, I mean, what they're looking at would change the law for next year. And the Senate version, I know the Senate's been really talking about this. They're looking at kind of giving districts that had significant technical troubles a pass this year. And I'd have to double check to see if that language is in the House version, but the Senate's been pretty adamant about that districts that experience these bugs shouldn't be held accountable, really, you know, moving forward.
I think they call it the escape. Was it Senator John Legge who said it was the escape valve or something of that phrasing? Another issue that has kind of been inching its way through, but it's kind of lying low, is the question of what's going to happen when part of the Seminole Gaming Compact expires. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it kind of seems like the House and Senate are at a standstill on this. There was a press conference the other day with the Seminole tribe, you know, trying to raise some awareness. There's a big omnibus gaming bill in the House, but it's not moving. What is going on with that?
That's a good question, and it's a question more for the House and for Governor Scott. I mean, if you talk to even the legislative leaders, they haven't really heard anything from Governor Scott's administration, and it's really on his administration to work out a deal with the Seminole tribe, because the compact, which was done in 2010, goes for 30 years, but there's a part of it that ensures a monopoly for banked card games for the tribe at their casinos throughout the state on things like blackjack and baccarat and stuff like that. That expires in July. And if it's allowed to expire, and a lot of legislative leaders seem like they're perfectly okay with that, then the tribe would have to stop those games, and there would have to be some sort of other arrangement. But you know, other than that pressing issue involved in the bill, it's just this pretty much the same story of, you know, the various and multiple and heavily lobbied interest groups involved in this issue sort of prepared to tear at each other to get what they want, and then end up possibly not getting anything through the legislature again.
And there's a lot of groups that want to see this expire, because for them, you know, why should one group have a monopoly on this?
True. And also, it's key to remember the compact was approved in 2010. The budget situation for the state is vastly different. Mm-hmm. In 2010, we were coming out, just getting out of recession, still facing drastic shortfalls. It was a case where, you know, to say we will be getting $200+ million a year was a big thing at the time. Now, lawmakers, even with all this issue with LIP and the questions over the budget, this is not putting a dent in those deliberations. There's not the need for cash that the state had then. So, for legislative leaders like House Speaker Steve Crisafulli and Senate President Andy Gardner, both of whom. Especially Senator Gardner, not always a foe of the gambling in general, doesn't even like the lottery, you know, prepared to, you know, just let this die out, it seems like.
And then there's prisons. We can't forget about those. Mm. I feel like, you know, you're in trouble when a state senator is doing drive-bys to your prison facility, you know, unannounced. I mean, that's what Senator Greg Evers did. And obviously, given all of the reporting on inmate deaths, given, you know, the reporting on problems within the system, you know, allegations of cronyism, we've had now former prison chiefs who say, yeah, there were some really big problems. There's ongoing testimony from correctional guards who said they feared retribution if they reported anything. I mean, obviously, this is a big problem, because prisons are a fairly significant, number one, portion of our budget, but they house a fairly significant portion of our population.
Yeah, no, and my colleagues at the Miami Herald have been doing some real excellent work, you know, mm-hmm. looking at some of these inmate deaths, you know, and the questions that have swirled around that, some of the issues with cronyism, you know, what folks who have wanted to come forward and bring whistleblower suits, and kind of what the ramifications have been on that end. It's been interesting, because one of the things we've been hearing is that, you know, the correction system needed more money. It's been starved of funding, you know, and had there been more staffers, or you know, had there been more resources, you know, some of these problems might not have happened. Also seeing a need, I think, for more money that would go into the facilities. You know, we've been hearing a lot about that too. And there does seem to be interest by the legislative leaders to try to address this situation. I mean, it's gotten an awful lot of ink in newspapers around the state. There seems to be a lot of interest in trying to figure out how do we you know, mitigate this to some extent. I think the budget is kind of the easy place to start, because we can find money, you know, to help. But kind of figuring out ways to undo some of the issues that are systemic and have been there for forever, you know, that are cultural, I think that's going to be the far heavier lift. And we'll see how lawmakers try to address those issues.
Yeah. Will the governor get his tax cuts?
That's a good question and something that is going to have to be answered. The answer is yes, but not necessarily the way he wants them, which is typically the case. But again, with all the budget questions early on, even not including the lip, but at least on the House side, when I saw when the allocations came out, they included enough room to have a tax cut package. Governor wanted $678 million or thereabouts, the lion's share of which would be in the form of cutting communication services taxes on cable, phone bills, stuff like that. I believe he said the average family with a $100 bill each month would end up saving $43 over the course of a year. So there's some other ideas, though, out there. Obviously, the legislature will have its own package that they develop. It's still early stages on. There is a bill to include that cut in the CST as the governor wanted, but that's a huge chunk of the overall tax package. So it's going to have to compete with some other ideas out there.
And as we near the midpoint of the 2015 lawmaking session, obviously a lot of stuff is still up in the air. And so I got to ask, Kathleen, what do you see as kind of going to be the main topic dominating the conversation, or even kind of what you see as the issue that's still flying under the radar?
That's still flying under the radar. I mean, as far as the issue that's going to continue to dominate the session, I do see that being the healthcare funding issue. I mean, it's going to be a big question mark. What is going to happen with the LIP funding? And the folks over at ACA, the Agency for Healthcare Administration, are really hopeful they'll be able to have a deal in place. Yeah, fingers crossed, exactly, by April. But frankly, the federal government is not working on the same timetable that the lawmakers are. You know, this is a program that expires June 30th. So if it continues, I mean, we could be headed toward an extended session or a special session or who knows what.
Hush your mouth.
I know. Knock on wood. But I think this will continue to suck a lot of air out of the room for the next couple of weeks.
Gray, how about you?
I think that's exactly right. Because, like I said before, it's tied up in the budget, and the Senate wants to include the Medicaid expansion in its budget, and the House obviously does not. That's something that's going to have to be resolved. Obviously, the only thing that they have to pass is the budget, but that's also the key to a lot of other. Usually in sessions, it can be the key to a lot of other deals when the money starts getting agreed upon. As far as something that flies under the radar, I think we mentioned it already. It's the gambling compact, because that's something that's not really within the hands of the legislature until there's a deal that is presented by the governor's office. And so far, there's not a whole lot of movement publicly. Especially, there's no movement publicly, but there's not really a whole. The legislature don't seem to know what's going on as far as talks. Are they progressing? So that's something to keep an eye on that could pop up, especially late in session, and sort of send a thrill through the rotunda.
Well, we will be watching and listening and reporting. Kathleen and Gray, thank you both so much for joining me here on It's About Florida.
Oh, thanks. It was a real pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to the Orlando Sentinel's Gray War and the Miami Herald's Kathleen McGrory, you've been listening to It's About Florida, a production of WFSU-FM. I'm Lynn Hatter. Taylor Cox provides technical assistance. Please join us again next month as we near the end of the 2015 lawmaking session.